Liebel Tina in for Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. And coming up, have you made an effort to support local farmers this summer? We talk with two Wisconsin farm owners about what it's been like to operate a farm during a pandemic. Up now, our next guest looked back at 100 years of American experience with the disease diabetes, what she started out looking for and what she found and then ended up pursuing in her new book. They're just not the same things. She challenges the framework of thinking about this disease and something that we can understand as simply affecting one race or one group of people disproportionately. There have been historically a variety of reasons to chalk up having diabetes to differences among races, but biology is not the whole story, and here to tell us about it is Arlene Marcia Tuckman. She's the Nelson O. Tyrone Jr. Professor of History and former director of the Center for Medicine, Health, and Society at Vanderbilt University. And we should note she received her PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and her latest book is called Diabetes, A History of Race and Disease. Arlene, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
We're happy to have you here. We do want to start way at the beginning, though, because you actually set out to tell more of the story of type 2 diabetes, and then you didn't end up writing that book. Why didn't it work?
Well, I realized at one point while I was doing my research that they didn't distinguish between type 1 and type 2 diabetes. Officially, they didn't make the distinction until the late 1970s. Probably a few decades before, there was a lot of discussion that they might be two different kinds of disease. But certainly in the time that I began in the late 19th century and for the first half of the 20th, they believed that diabetes was one disease. They certainly were aware that if you developed it when you were young, your prognosis was much worse. You would probably die within a few years. And if you developed it when you were middle-aged or elderly, that you had a much better prognosis. But they thought of it as one disease. So that I ended up realizing that it would be anachronistic for me to think that I was writing a book of type 2, just about type 2 diabetes.
What inspired you in the first place? Because your other books, they're not about diabetes.
Correct. Well, as an historian of medicine, I had long been interested in the history of disease. And the deciding factor was when my dad moved to Nashville in 2002. He had been diagnosed with diabetes in the 1980s when he was 65. And interestingly, he was misdiagnosed. They assumed he had type 2 diabetes. He was 65, and age is a risk factor. He was short and rather overweight. And so they assumed that he had type 2 diabetes. It took about a year and a different physician until they realized that he had a rarer form of diabetes called LADA, or latent autoimmune diabetes of adulthood, which has similarities to type 1. So his body did not produce any insulin. And from that point, for the remaining 28 years of his life, he injected insulin four times a day.
You used the word assumed there, that people assumed, physicians assumed that this was his disease. And your book really is about all of the assumptions that we make when we think about diabetes and who it affects.
Yes, absolutely. You know, the irony didn't escape me that had my dad been diagnosed 100 years earlier, it would have seemed perfectly natural that my dad had diabetes because we're Jewish, and the assumption in the late 19th century and well into the 20th century was that the population that was most at risk of developing diabetes was white people in general and Jews in particular. There was even a belief that people of who were African American, Native American, that they had an immunity.
And you take different pieces of your book to try to tackle this idea that certain people have immunity or certain people are more predisposed simply by genetics, because it's not just about genetics. It goes beyond our genetic makeup.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, even before genes were actually discovered, right, they were still talking about biological traits. So one of the arguments in my book is that as researchers noticed that diabetes was distributed unevenly among different populations that they viewed as races, when they saw these health disparities, that consistently they explained these disparities by pointing either to the biology or genetics or to the behaviors of the particular racial groups. Mm-hmm. And that shifted over the course of the 20th century from believing that, as I mentioned, that whites and particularly Jews were most likely to develop diabetes to viewing Native Americans as most susceptible, African Americans, and then Hispanic Americans. And the explanations always focused on the biology and behavior of those populations.
And why are you finding that's not true?
Well, I want to give my historical actors some credit. There was always a minority of voices who argued that that one had to pay attention to the living conditions, whether it was poverty or discrimination. So Jews who and Jewish physicians who actually accepted that they had a higher rate of diabetes claimed that it was because of the millennia of discrimination that they had been subjected to that made their nervous system somewhat unstable and made them susceptible to nervous diseases. What's really important about this is that nervous diseases were considered to be diseases of civilization, that only those who were most advanced had the most developed nervous system. And the downside of that is that it it made it more likely that you would develop a nervous disease.
Arlene Tuckman has written a book about diabetes and the factors that play roles in whose bodies actually develop this disease. And there's room for you in this conversation here on Central Time. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. What changes would you like to see in how we think about disease and race as a culture or as a community? What questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call. Arlene, a lot of your writing deals with race and really racism. So yes. How did that become intertwined with diabetes?
So the explanations, as I mentioned, that always looked to racial traits and to behaviors that were linked with particular races, that always masked what was going on around the communities that were suffering so much. So what interests me is how people are living in particular conditions that make them sick. And yet when the medical community or the public health community, but also popular writers, so in newspapers and magazines, when they try and explain why a particular population had a high rate, they are ignoring all of the factors that are products of racism, and they are attributing the high disease rates to the biology and behaviors of the population.
Then how much can we attribute to doctors, to political leaders, white or non-white Americans using certain language when thinking or talking about diabetes?
How much can we?
I guess, for lack of a better word, how much can we blame them? I mean, how much of this is a part? How much of it, you know, matters the way that we talk about it, you know, when we have facts?
Yeah. So I really would like to get away from the language of blame because I want to get away from what really predominates today, but has always been part of the way that we look at disease, and I would say especially diabetes, and that is our inclination to blame people for being sick. So maybe what I would say is that physicians are a part of our culture, and they always have been. They are not immune from the kinds of language and representations that circulate through our society. So we have to stop thinking that by virtue of something being medical or even having a disease label, that it is neutral. In fact, diseases really are sites where false claims about a population's racial makeup get absorbed and they get reproduced. So I think in terms of what goes on within the clinical encounter, it would be really wonderful if medical schools would do some anti-racism training. I'm sure some are. And just ramp it up. We all heard recently about the Ohio state senator who lost his job as an emergency room physician because he blamed high COVID rates among African American people on the fact that they don't wash their hands enough. And that kind of statement, we know that he spoke it out loud, but that others are also thinking this, and we have to tackle that.
Yeah. Arlene, thank you for that framing, that way to think about it. We're talking with Arlene Tuckman. She's written a book about diabetes and how race and really racism play a role in whose bodies have to cope with this disease. And there's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a connection with this history of diabetes? Do you have the disease? When were you diagnosed? And what has your experience been like? We want to bring you into this conversation, and you can join us at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Our conversation continues here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. Thanks for joining us on Central Time. We're talking about diabetes and not just how our genes influence whether we'll deal with the disease, but also how race and class and other circumstances factor into our risk. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Arlene Tuckman is our guest, and we're taking your questions at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest who studied the history of this disease? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. And we'll go ahead now and take a caller. Anne from Waukesha is on the line and wants to join our conversation. Hi, Anne.
Hi, you guys. Thank you for having this conversation. I have history of diabetes and have been insulin dependent since for the last, I would say, 5 years. I have a father who had it, a great grandfather who died of Bright's disease, which is what they called, I guess, the kidney disease. And I'm really struggling with the cost right now of treating the disease. I know historically it couldn't be treated, but now it can be treated, but the expense of insulin is extraordinary. I wonder if you could comment on that.
And thank you so much for bringing up treatment and the cost of managing this. And, Arlene, what do you think here?
Yeah, there really isn't a treatment for diabetes, as I'm sure you know. What we have developed over time are better and better ways of managing the disease and managing the highs and the lows. And you're absolutely right. The cost of treatment is horrendous. And the more advanced technologies that we have are like pumps. They're just out of reach for individuals who are not very comfortable financially. And I think this just points to how much we need to have an overhaul of our healthcare system and to have universal care and to healthcare and to be able to negotiate reasonable drug prices with the pharmaceutical companies.
Because when we're talking about people who can't afford the different ways that you manage diabetes, we're talking about class, which also plays into every piece of the history of what we know about diabetes.
Yes, absolutely. And poverty is a big part of how diabetes has been reimagined. What I would like to add to this is that people who are living in poverty, no matter what their skin color, are with many of the same issues. But when we're talking about populations of color, we are we have to also pay attention to the physiological, the biological effects of racism, and that when you are confronted in every aspect of your life with racist practices and racist policies and racist beliefs, you often develop chronic stress. And we know that chronic stress produces, dumps more cortisol into your system, and this increases your risk of developing chronic diseases. So, you know, I grew up talking about the difference between nature and nurture, but research that demonstrates that our environment can directly alter our biological, our physiological state, then that just explodes that that distinction.
We are talking with Arlene Tuckman, who's written a book about diabetes and the factors that play into who gets it and how we manage it. And there's room for you in this conversation at 800-642-1234. James from Appleton wants to join us. Hi, James.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks. What's on your mind?
Well, I got diabetes about a year ago, type 2. And when I was in the ER being diagnosed, the emergency room doctor was really pushing for insulin and that I should be on insulin the rest of my life. Having read a book on diabetes and having a mother who was a diabetic, I chose diet and exercise, and now 80 pounds down and a year later, I don't take any pills, and I just manage it with diet and exercise, and it can be done. You don't have to be reliant on the medicine or the pills if you're willing to do what needs to be done to get it, you know, to get it under control.
Yeah, James, congratulations on that work for sure. It worked for James. But Arlene, James talks about a significant weight loss, and that brings us back to the idea, the assumptions about obesity and diabetes. And there's a medical connection, but it's not always what we think.
Yeah, also, congratulations. That's really wonderful news. And what I would like to say about this is that we do have a way of thinking about diabetes as a diabetes over which people have choices, around which people have choices. And that if they just decide to exercise and eat well, then they can lose weight and no longer have the symptoms of diabetes. But that whole frame assumes that you have the resources to do that. It assumes that you have enough control over your daily activities, that you're not trying to manage how to live on unemployment or how to live on food stamps. It is developed within a framework of people being able to get to supermarkets and buy healthy foods. And so I actually think that this language of choosing is what feeds into a language of blaming. And what I would really prefer to see is that we pay attention to all of the constraints that people are struggling with that make it difficult for them to make the kinds of choices that we know can improve our health. So it's just not the same when you're living in deep poverty as when you have access to resources.
And this relates somewhat to Charlie called in to ask if there's a difference in the way diabetes is managed in other countries that don't have the racial problems that America does. Arlene?
I'm not an expert on that. Certainly in other countries, and I would say what's more important is whether there's universal health care, and then also what kind of attention and what kind of financial investment is placed in public health. But there are lots of other countries where they may not have the racial problems, but they certainly have stark class differences.
Mm. What do we need to do then to free ourselves from the assumptions that we've pointed out, to really push ourselves to think about this differently and break this chain of race-related diagnosis of diabetes?
Well, I think we have to change how we think about disease causation. We have to stop blaming, and we need to do what we can to create conditions that help people make healthy choices. I don't know if I have time to give an example here,
sure.
But I would like to say that when I think about the parallels to COVID-19, we have a long history of explaining health disparities by blaming particular racial traits. We also have a long history of counter arguments, so where small groups would try to draw attention to discrimination and to poverty. But that latter argument has had a really hard time gaining traction. There were moments like during the civil rights movement and the war on poverty, but then the Reagan era came and all of that was dismantled. And I'd say we're at a similar crossroads today. The question is, what will happen post-COVID? And I just want to give one example of how racist beliefs become part of how we normalize our conversation around COVID-19.
Yeah, we have about 20 seconds, Arlene. Go ahead.
Okay. We have to stop blaming high rates of COVID-19 on high rates of diabetes and other comorbidities. All of them stem from the same environmental and social conditions that make people sick. Mm.
Thank you for that. Arlene, we've really appreciated this conversation. Thanks for your time.
You're welcome. I was glad to be here.
Arlene Marcia Tuckman is a professor of history at Vanderbilt University. Her new book out this month is called Diabetes, A History of Race and Disease. Coming up after the news, we hear from two Wisconsin farmers about how the pandemic has affected their 2020 season. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, disagreements between Congress and the White House have again stalled plans to provide financial relief to people as the COVID-19 pandemic tanks the economy. We'll learn more about what's happening on Capitol Hill ahead. First, farmers are in the business of uncertainty, and this season's variables have been even more extreme than the normal risks. Farmers' markets were delayed, canceled, or operating at reduced capacity. Restaurants closed, or they're serving fewer people, so they're cutting down on their wholesale vegetable orders. And let's not even talk about the weather and commodity prices. We are going along with the ups and downs of the season so far with two Wisconsin farmers. Tracy Vins is a co-owner and grower of Olden Organics. That's a certified organic produce farm based in Ripon, Wisconsin. Tracy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Certainly. And Sean Kuhn is co-founder and co-owner of Vitruvian Farms based in McFarland, Wisconsin. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's just start out. I know it's hard to think all the way back to March when this first started. Sean, what worries did you have at that time?
I would say we had a full existential crisis because the way we situated our farm for the last 10 years is our main source of income was selling to about 50 different restaurants and a couple of grocery stores in the Madison and surrounding area. So every year we get about 80% of our income from selling wholesale to these restaurants and the grocery stores. And when we first learned about the possibility of the restaurants closing down, we literally had no idea what we were going to do. So it kind of put us into a state of fear. I guess everyone was was feeling a lot of fear at the time. But luckily, we were able to come up with some ideas about different avenues that we could sell through, because obviously we knew the same amount of food was going to be consumed in the community. It was just going to be the medium by which people got the food was going to change. So we ended up creating a online store where people can order produce from our farm and it gets delivered straight to their door. And we also created a contactless pickup system on our farm. It's basically a drive-through system. So there's no contact with people, keeps everything safe. And when we launched the online store, we started aggregating from other local producers because we realized there was a lot of other producers that were in the same predicament that we were in. And so we kind of teamed up, and together we found a new way to distribute the food that we were producing.
Tracy, take us back there too for you. What were you concerned about? And then how did you just kind of take that first step? Because there was a lot of uncertainty and it remains.
Yeah, I mean, back in, gosh, to think March wasn't that long ago, but it feels like forever. My husband and I we didn't know what we were going to do. Winter farmers markets shut down pretty quickly. And we tried to wrap our head around what exactly was happening and what we could do. And like Sean, we changed paths and we set up an online store. And we were doing home delivery from the Appleton area all the way to the Milwaukee area. We reached out to many other local producers, just like Sean did. Actually, we reached out to Sean. And we were selling his products through our site, as well as 25 to 30 other producers. And we found it was amazing, the outcry of people wanting local food, but at the same time wanting it brought to them. We still are doing that today. And we're finding it more limited because there are farmers markets going on right now. And I think people just want to get out. So they are venturing out to farmers markets as much as they can. But I think they're still supporting us local farms as much as they can as well. And right now, we don't know. We don't know what the future holds. We're doing only one farmers market instead of the three that we regularly do. We're still delivering to the grocery stores that we have been, but restaurants and then schools, we usually do a lot with a lot of the school systems. That's pretty much come to a screeching halt. Very much like Sean, it was very eye-opening and very scary there for a little while, but we were very appreciative for all the people who wanted to help us local farms.
Yeah, we're talking with two Wisconsin farmers about their experience growing and selling produce in a pandemic. Tracy Vinz's farm is based in Ripon. Sean Coons's operation is based in McFarland. And you're listening to the Ideas Network. And Sean, how do you describe the demand and interest in fresh produce in these last few months? Does it look different than in other years?
Yeah, I would say over the last 10 years, we've seen a big increase in demand for locally grown and produced food. And when COVID happened, I would say it just kind of skyrocketed. And we were trying to figure out, what was going on exactly. And I think partly it was the fear factor where people didn't know where there was the potential run on food at the grocery stores. We didn't know how everything was going to unfold. So people were kind of had a stock up mindset for a little bit. But also we saw the industrial food system, which is really centralized and has really big factories, whatnot, with a lot of people working in proximity. We saw a couple of those factories shut down, which affected the production of meat and the distribution of meat. And so for us, we were distributing locally produced meat from a couple other farmers, and they were selling more than they ever had, which was really good. And I think it really signified the importance of the local food system in terms of what it provides to the community in the sense of resiliency over efficiency. The industrial food system that we've grown up around is really efficient and works really well as long as nothing breaks down. And now we're seeing with a worldwide crisis, suddenly there's a chain of events that affects all types of industries. And when that affects farmers, that affects everyone. So I think it's really highlighted the importance of the local food movement. And I think people have really caught on to recently some of the benefits of having a more localized food system that maybe we haven't thought about much recently.
Well, and I'll say to your point, Tracy, about the schools, schools aren't buying as much from you, obviously, because they haven't had kids in school. But at my house, there are kids at home now, and I'm at home for every meal. And so we are looking to just buy more out of sheer necessity. How have you seen the demand for fresh produce in these months as people have tried to figure out what's safe, but also how to feed their families?
Yeah, I mean, I'll echo exactly what Sean had said. The demand has just been, it's been amazing. It's great that we're having a good growing season as well, so that we're able to meet as much of the demand as we possibly can. I think people are scared that they're going to go to the grocery store and it's not going to be, you know, what they want is not going to be there. And they're scared where they're finally starting to think, where is my food coming from? And how many hands are touching it? So coming back to the local farms, they're feeling more secure about their food, which is amazing. And it's certainly helping all of us local farms.
And Tracy, we know we've heard some things. We've talked about coronavirus relief for farmers. Wisconsin has a farm support program. How important has that been to your farm or to farmers you know?
I've talked to some, to some farms that have received some relief. As for ourselves, we have not received any of the farm relief. We were able to get in on the PPP loan, the payroll protection loan, but that's all that we have done at this time. I'm not sure about others.
Yeah, Sean, have you experienced or talked to anybody who has found support in the systems that we have, or maybe is looking for support, more support from the systems we've got?
I have not talked to anyone that has experience with the farm aid. We're very similar to Tracy. We did get a little bit of relief at the beginning when things were more tumultuous with the PPP loan, which was really helpful in the transition period when sales kind of went down before switching our markets. But I'm not sure which farms have utilized the farm aid.
Sure. So it really sounds like you're really relying on customers, on existing customers, on new customers to keep these real crucial businesses afloat.
We are. And one thing with the financial assistance that's out there through the USDA for farmers, it's not helping us local fresh produce farms. It's helping the commodity farms. It's helping anyone that had had crops in storage in March that wasn't sold. So any of us that grow fresh and sell fresh direct, we haven't gotten any aid for that at all. So, I mean, our aid has been local people, and we're very appreciative for that.
Yeah. I mean, how do you begin if you don't know a farmer? How do you even start to get in touch if this is something that, someone listening is hearing and thinks, wow, I really want to support these local farms, but I don't know anybody.
Sean, do you want to take that?
Yeah, sure. I would say I think I can speak for us and Tracy's farm. We're both on the internet, so you can just start with Googling local farms. You know, you can Google Vitruvian Farms if you're around Madison. You can Google Olden Organics if you're up in the Ripon area. But the number of local farms has really grown over the last 10 years for sure. And a lot of them are on the internet. So if you go to Google and just type in local, maybe organic produce, I think it's likely that you'll find something. Otherwise, finding out where your local co-op grocery store sources their food from, or just talking with family or searching on Facebook. A lot of the farms are present online, so I think that's a really good way to find us.
All right, that's helpful. Thank you so much. We are talking with two Wisconsin farmers about their experience selling produce in a pandemic. We've got Tracy Vins and Sean Kuhn, who have been explaining what they've been experiencing here during this pandemic as local growers who are no longer supplying things necessarily to schools or large manufacturers or businesses, but really are now reaching out to people and who are connecting with it, maybe in the form of a CSA or just by local farmers markets or delivery services. And we are taking your calls now at 800-642-1234. You can join this conversation to tell us, have you been buying more directly from farmers this year than you have before? Have you realized that you've had to stock up and keep buying more fresh produce now that you've been home more often? Maybe you work an essential job and you haven't been in that position. What are you seeing when it comes to how you're choosing to feed yourself and your family during this time? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we are continuing this conversation here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. And welcome back to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. We're talking with two Wisconsin farmers right now. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. And Sean Kuhn is with us from a farm in McFarland, Wisconsin. Tracy Vinn is with us from one in Ripon. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. And Tim from Oshkosh is ready to talk with us. Hey, Tim.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. What's on your mind?
Well, my wife and I, earlier this year when the pandemic was kind of first coming around, decided to do a vegetable CSA with a local farm. And it has been the most beneficial thing that we could have ever done. I think we'll probably do it every year now. And it feels good to be supporting local farmers, knowing that our produce is coming from just on the road from us, and that we are giving our money locally as opposed to buying produce that's also being shipped across the country. So it's our fridge is always stocked with fresh vegetables now, and it's just been a really beneficial thing for us.
Tim, thanks for sharing that experience with us, and I'm glad it's going well for you with that investment in a CSA. Tracy, tell us what a CSA is.
So a CSA is it stands for Community Supported Agriculture. Basically, in a nutshell, the general public is able to buy shares of a private farm. And so you pay ahead, you pay early in the season to the farm. And then once the season starts and the farm is producing produce, you receive a bounty, from that farm or from a number of farms, if it's a collaborative effort, throughout the growing season. So your money is given to the farm ahead of time so that they can buy their seed, invest in equipment, start their season out with a little bit of money in the bank to ensure that all of their costs are going to be covered.
And Tracy, part of your operation includes a CSA, right?
We used to do a CSA, yep. We stopped that about 3 years ago when we put in a commercial processing center here on the farm.
Oh, wow. And then, Sean, does yours operate out of a CSA, or do you have a different setup for your farm?
We do also have a CSA. Ours is relatively small in comparison to other CSA farms because it is kind of a side part of our farm. But we do offer the traditional CSA box, and we also offer something that's a little bit newer more unconventional. It's a free choice card, we call it, but it's a similar concept to a CSA box where you pay ahead at the beginning of the season to give the farmer money for supplies and seeds. And then you actually get a slight bonus, but then you get to choose throughout the season on a week-to-week basis what you actually want. So it gives customers a bit more preference in what they're receiving.